Yesterday we spoke about the Council of Nicaea, and then went on to speak about the Arian controversy afterwards. During all the rest of Athanasius' life, he considered the Council of Nicaea as one of the great achievements of his reign. And indeed it was. If you could have been there when the Council of Nicaea began and seen the bishops coming in, some of them with eyes that had been gouged out, one eye gouged out in the persecution, others missing a hand or an arm, and others with brand marks of irons on their faces, and seeing what they had gone through. And now, after that terrible persecution, now they were called together and presided over by the emperor himself in order to consider what was for the welfare of the church. And Constantine was greatly impressed with the careful way in which they considered the doctrinal matter and the study of the scripture and the deliberations and the final, almost complete unanimity in signing the creed that the council adopted. And he never would have willingly let anyone turn against this creed or run it down in his presence. And so during the rest of Constantine's reign, there was no open Arianism in the empire. There was no public effort to make Arianism again be prominent. But there was a group of people who were devoted to Arian teaching who were determined to establish them in the empire. And they set to work very carefully and very skillfully in order to undermine the characters of the leaders of the opposition to Arianism, to get them into difficulty as much as possible, and to get themselves back into favor and into power again. Eusebius of Nicomedia, whom we have noticed was one of the leaders of the Arian faction, had, when he saw how things were going, had stopped talking in the council for Arianism and actually signed the creed at the end. Nevertheless, he had been so prominent in the agitation for Arianism that he was one of the few men who were exiled at the end. He was exiled, but his friends were working to try to get him brought back. And eventually they succeeded. And not only was he brought back to his place as Bishop of Nicomedia, but he was able to become a very good friend again of Emperor Constantine. And in fact, it was he who Constantine had baptized him, and to whom Constantine looked for advice on many points. He was back, he joined with the others who were trying to destroy the character and the power of the bishops who were favoring the Nicene standard. One of these men, who had been one of the strongest for the Nicene standard, was accused of Sabellianism. Now, it's unlikely this man actually was a Sabellian, but he perhaps was a little further in that direction than he should have been. He certainly was much further in that direction than Athanasius was. But he was accused of Sabellianism, and a council convicted him of that, and he was out from power. Then they took another of the leaders, and they managed to bring a moral complaint against him, a man who had been a great leader for the cause before these charges were brought. We have no way at this time of knowing whether he actually had been guilty of moral sin, or whether he had been somewhat indiscreet, or whether the whole thing was a frame. We don't know. But at any rate, his influence was destroyed, and he himself removed as any important factor in the church. And thus they went after one and another of the leaders without coming out and saying that Arianism played any part in their activity. I believe I made number small a here under three, the work of Athanasius. And yes? This is, there was quite a group of them. Yes, that was done, I believe, by one of Eusebius' associates while Eusebius was still in exile. But there was a group of them which was working together. Eusebius may have been the brains behind the group. In the latter part, he was one of the most active. But we call A the work of Athanasius, small a, and we'll call B the political maneuvers of the Arians. And they
managed over the period of years to quiet Constantine's suspicions of them and fear of them, and they managed to pick off the leaders one by one on one charge or another. Athanasius had become bishop at the age of 30, and here he had a position which the Council of Nicaea had recognized as giving him authority over the church all through Egypt. And he was bishop of the largest city in Egypt, one of the three or four greatest cities in the world at the time. And during the 10 years after he was made bishop, I guess not quite 10, during about 8 years, he proved himself to be such an able administrator, such an excellent preacher, such a fine pastor, and so very fine in his philanthropies and in his interest in the well-being of all the people of Alexandria, including the Jews and the pagans of the city, that he came to be almost universally beloved in the city, greatly admired by the great bulk of the people of Egypt. And the Arians did not do anything against Athanasius until they had gotten rid of a good many of the men who would have stood with Athanasius. And then they felt Eusebius got back into from his exile and became active in the movement, and they felt the time had come now when they would dare attack Athanasius. Well, anyone who is involved in as many activities as a man in Athanasius' position was, and a man who was not merely filling a position but who was actively working for what he believed to be true all the time, cannot help getting involved in situations in which it is possible to bring charges and attacks against him, truly, whether truly or falsely. And so they began to bring charges against Athanasius. They began to try to poison Constantine's mind against him, and they began looking for things of which he could be accused. And a council was held at Tyre, to which he was summoned to appear to hear charges against his administration. And Athanasius went to this council with 50 bishops with him from Egypt. But when he got there, he found that there was a far larger number of bishops there who were already strongly poisoned against him. And we won't take time to go into the various charges they made, most of which he's fairly easily disproved. But one charge was difficult to disprove. That was that he had murdered a man named Arsenius, a bishop of one of the Miletian bishops. That is the group, you remember, which had made this schism in Egypt during the persecution. The Council of Nicaea had tried to bring them back into full union again, but these Miletian bishops threw in their lot mostly with the Arians. And Arsenius was a bishop, one of the Miletian bishops. And they said that he had murdered Arsenius. Well, Athanasius, of course, knew there was absolutely nothing to this charge, but how could you disprove the charge when they even brought a hand, which they said was Arsenius's hand, which they said Athanasius had kept to use for magical purposes, and they claimed that they had stolen out of his residence. But Athanasius' friends hunted frantically for evidence about the truth regarding Arsenius, and finally discovered that the man himself had been prevailed upon to hide in order that they could bring this charge. And so the friends managed to find him, and for a time he refused to admit his identity, but then they proved it to him, but they kept very quiet about this. So then when Athanasius was being accused of this and other things, Athanasius said, "How many of there are you here who know Arsenius, who would know him if you saw him?" And about a third of the people raised their hands. And then he said, "Well, just a minute, please." And he stepped to the door. And he brought a man in with a big coat on and with his head sort of wrapped with a head covering so that you couldn't really see much of him. He got the man there and he pulled back the covering and he said, "See, here's Arsenius." Then he said, "Pull out your right hand." He pulled it up and he said, "Pull out your left." And he pulled it up. And Athanasius said, "I never knew a man who had more than two hands." Well, the council, in spite of Athanasius disproving the charges, there was such a movement against him that the majority was determined to take a decision that he should not be permitted to continue as a bishop of Alexandria. And So Athanasius went to Constantinople to present his case to the emperor. And when he came to Constantinople, he presented the answer to the charges to Constantine. There's quite a history in addition. I'm not taking the time to tell you of different dealings with Constantine, with the council and so on before this. But Constantine, when he was wondering what to do about it, they said that Athanasius had held back the grain ships that brought grain from Egypt to feed the people of Constantinople. And Constantine had a very great interest in the well-being of the people in Constantinople, and some said that even the suspicion of a man having done this was enough to make him determined to take action. We don't know why Constantine took action. Later on, Constantine's son said that Constantine saw that there was such an enmity against Athanasius that in order to protect Athanasius' life, he took the action. We don't know. At any rate, he ordered that he be exiled to Trade, a city in the Rhineland. It was one of the leading Roman cities in that part of the world, which was then comparatively under the... But this was quite a fine city, but a distance that would take some weeks to travel to get there from Eden. And so he was banished, and then they prevailed on Constantine before long to consider letting Arius come back from banishment. Arius had been banished for 10 years, nearly 10 years. And they told Constantine that Arius had been misrepresented. He really didn't hold these views they claimed he had. And there were some letters went back and forth, and Arius wrote a letter in which, in answer to Constantine's questions, he very cleverly sidestepped all the matters so that he could make the emperor think that he accepted the Nicene Creed, while actually he did not go back on any of his previous positions. And Arius was brought back then from exile, and the church in Egypt was ordered to receive him back into full communion again in the church. And someone said that they felt that surely that Arius, for his perjury in the statements he made for Constantine, that surely Arius would suffer for that some way, sometime. Well, the great service was planned at which Arius should appear and be received back publicly into the church again. And while he was on the way to the service, Arius was taken with sudden pains and died on the way. And so he didn't get there. And so he was not received back into the church. But in Egypt, the enemies of Athanasius were in control, though not daring to say that they were supporting the Arians as yet. But they were in control. And Athanasius was in exile, but writing letters. He sent his Easter letters out from Trade. For the year and a half he was there, he sent out two Easter letters telling what the day of Easter was and exhorting people to follow the Lord. He was given every freedom in Trade. The governor there was very friendly to him. The bishop was extremely cordial to him, but he was there in exile. And then that was 336 when he was sent, and 337 is when Constantine died. Well, I see that it would have been good just for completeness of outline, after B, the political maneuvers, to say small c, the exile of Athanasius, and small d, the return and death of Arius. And now Constantine died, and we must say that Constantine, his understanding of Christianity was doubtless very imperfect. But he would seem to have been an honest and honorable man, a rude soldier, some say, but certainly a very skillful politician and an able statesman, and one who sincerely believed in as much of Christianity as he understood, and one who sincerely was anxious to advance Christianity while at the same time giving full rights of religious liberty to all the other people of the empire. And Constantine died, and naturally the whole situation changes with the end of the life of a man of his great power and influence. And so we take, we call capital E, this was small d we just had, but now we take capital D, the reign of Constantius. Constantius. The reign of Constantius. 337 to 361. 337 to 361. You see, we have a period here of a quarter of a century. And this quarter of a century is dominated by Constantine's youngest son, Constantius.
We will have a good bit to say about him, so I am entitling the heading, the E here, the reign of Constantius, but I'm going to call number one under it, the sons of Constantine. When Constantine died, he left three sons. Constantine II, who was 21, Constans, who was 19, and Constantius, who was 17. Well, these three sons then would rule the empire between them. There were also nephews, there were younger brothers of Constantine, and a number of nephews and close relatives who seemed to think that they had a right to considerable voice in the control of the empire and the soldier sphere. Yes? Constantine II was the oldest. And Constans, C-O-N-S-T-A-N-S. And the youngest I was called Constantius. The soldiers, fearing that there would be civil war and division among the caused by the desires of Constantine's relatives for a share of power, massacred all of Constantine's relatives except the three sons. And so his nephews and other relatives were all killed except two little boys, and of course his three sons. And these two little boys, we will notice later on. I merely mentioned their existence at this point. They were quite young. But the three sons got together and decided that Constantine II should rule at the extreme west. Out of France, Spain, Britain. Constans should rule Italy and the regions north of it, and some little distance east from there. And Constantius should have the eastern territory. And they made that arrangement. Constantine II had previously been governor at Thrace, where Athanasius was. He was very friendly with Athanasius, and he told Constantius, yes? Yes. Well, I find it spelled two ways. Sometimes they spell it T-R-E-V-E-S, and sometimes they spell it T-R-I-E-R. I don't know just why the difference, but some books use one and some the other. I suppose different languages that were in which it was written. This is the city where had been exiled. And when he was in exile there, Constantine II was there. So Constantine II thought very highly of him. And he talked to Constantius about bringing Athanasius back to Alexandria. And Constantius agreed to do it. So Alexandria was in the territory under Constantius' rule. And Constantius later proved to be a bitter enemy of Athanasius. He was a man of very jealous disposition. Some say he was a very weak character under the influence of the people in his household. We can't prove about that. He had a tremendous influence in the next 24 years, partly because he was the survivor after the other two brothers were gone. Well, Constantine II only lived for 3 years after this. Then there was civil war, and Constantine II was killed. And so Constans and Constantius divided up the empire between the two of them. Constans reigned in the west and Constantius in the east. And now that Constantine II was gone, Constantius began to prove himself to be very favorable to the Arians. And one of his first acts had been to take Eusebius of Nicomedia and make him bishop of Constantinople, the capital of his section of the empire. And although Eusebius only lived about another 3 years, you see his influence and that of those who were associated with him in what followed. Now, just a very brief summary before we look at the important events of this period of the fate of the sons of Constantine. We notice that Constantine II died in 340. That means that for the next 10 years, half the empire, instead of a third, was under Constantius' control, but the other half was under Constans' control, the control of Constans. And Constans had quite a bit of influence with Constantius. That is, it was important they could work together, and so Constantius advanced Arians in his area constantly, in his region. And not only people who belonged to the Arian party, but they began coming out and speaking boldly with their Arian views. But Constans was very friendly to Athanasius, and his influence was sufficient to prevent anything being done against Athanasius for a little time. Then, however, in 350, after 10 years of Constantine's rule over half the empire, one of his generals raised a conspiracy against him and murdered him and seized control of his half of the empire. That was in 350. And this general, don't bother with his name, Magnentius, but Magnentius sent a group to commission to go and see Athanasius in Egypt and try to get Athanasius' friendship for him. Now, Athanasius was very careful not to let himself get implicated in any way in it. So he was later falsely accused of having favored Magnentius. But Constantius set to work to avenge his brother, and it was 3 years of fighting before Magnentius was defeated and killed. And when that happened in 353, Constantius was now in complete control of the empire. And now you began to see what Constantius really stood for. He had complete control of the empire, and he determined to make Arianism absolutely supreme in the entire empire. Yes? Yes. Yes. Here, this is after. Right after Constantine's death, he was released and allowed to go back to Egypt. That's why I mentioned, I didn't spend much time on it, it was the result of Constantine's second influence on Constantius. Right after Constantine's death, Constantine's second, who strongly favored Constantius, asked him to let Athanasius come back. And Constantius greeted him in a very friendly fashion and received him back, allowed him to go to Alexandria and to become established there. And there in Alexandria, Athanasius was welcomed with great honor and began to rule there to exert himself as bishop. But soon after that, they began to try to bring charges against Athanasius again and make trouble for him. But he was back there for a little time, and then they sent to Rome his enemy. And they asked the bishop of Rome to come out against Athanasius. And the bishop of Rome, already Athanasius, knowing what they were doing, sent representatives to present his side to the bishop of Rome. And then, under Constantius' influence, efforts were made against Athanasius to where he saw his life in danger, and he fled to Rome. And there in Rome, the bishop of Rome was very friendly to Athanasius. He called a big council, which investigated all the charges against him, said there was Athanasius was absolutely guiltless in these charges. But Athanasius, after a few years more in Egypt, he had to go to Rome and spend 9 years, seven or nine, I forget, between the two, in Rome. And he spent that time in Rome in exile again, was constantly writing and standing for his beliefs, while in Egypt, unworthy men were put in his place. And they proved so unworthy that it turned the people's favor more and more towards Athanasius. So the ranks of the file of the people, though there were leaders who were very anxious to injure him. Now we could take a few hours going into the details of this period of 24 years. But the important thing in the period is how Constantius used the power of the empire to try to destroy the belief in the Nicene Creed and to establish Arianism. And how, during the first half of the period, the influence of the other two brothers kept Constantius from being able to do anything against it in the West. But during the last half of the last 10 years of the period, nearly 10 years, Constantius was supreme in the whole empire. And so during this period, Constantius was bringing the whole force of the empire to try to establish Arianism. And in the course of his whole life, Athanasius was exiled 5 times. He had about as many ups and downs as anybody you can picture in history. And his life was in danger time after time. But his very careful writings, his brilliant expositions of the scripture, his strong stand, and his very fine discernment in seeing
people's position, who in some cases sounded as if they didn't fully agree with him, and yet their hearts were really in the right direction, and he would try to deal with them and to explain. And others who, like Arius and Eusebius, tried to talk as if they agreed with him and yet were taking the opposite stand, he was able to discern the differences and to exert a tremendous influence even during the time when he was in exile. Yes? I think he believed him. But how great his understanding was, how deep his belief, I don't know. But as far as political reasons are concerned, Constantius had absolute control of the empire. He was not gaining anything for himself by it. It may be that it was people in his household. There was a eunuch there, another man named Eusebius, who had a tremendous influence over him. Some blame it on him. Some blame it on different people. Because you find him changing at times, being very friendly, fascinating, and at times very hostile. But I think most of those cases can be explained by the situation in his relation to his brother. My own guess is that he's a much stronger character than most of his friends. I think he sincerely was convinced by Eusebius and Nicomedia and these others that this is what should be established and who wanted to establish. That's my guess. But we are pretty hard to make a difference even if you were close to make a real decision on a person's character. However, some have said it is a wonderful thing for the Christian church that when you got an emperor who was determined to make his ideas supreme and to use imperial force to enforce them upon the church, that it was not a man who was trying to enforce Orthodox Christianity, but one who was actually persecuting Orthodox Christianity. It probably, it was pretty disagreeable to the people at the time. It probably was a good thing in the end. Because the great heroes of the faith at this period were men who were under constant danger and constant difficulty from the empire and were striving to stand for the truth against opposition. And the ones who were persecuting and trying to enforce uniformity of view were those who were standing for the Arian viewpoint. But a Constantius' reign was a very difficult time for the Orthodox. Bishop, we noticed the Bishop of Rome named Julius, who was friendly to Athanasius, and who carefully investigated all the charges and found there was no real complaint could be made against him. Well, before Constantius got control of the whole empire, he had died and was succeeded by a man named Liberius. And Constantius, now that he was in control of the empire, summoned Liberius to come to a council that he was having, Constantius was having held up in the northern Balkans. And when Liberius got there, he was put in prison and told that he could not get out until he signed an Arian creed. And after he was faithful to his belief for a year or two, and then finally he got so tired of being in prison that he came out and signed the Arian creed, and then was permitted to go back to Rome again. But this was the Bishop of Rome, Liberius, Hosius of Cordova, who had presided at the Council of Nicaea. Hosius was seized and was forced to sign an Arian creed by Constantius. And then later on, Hosius repudiated what he had done and declared that in his old age, under the force and compulsion of Constantius, he had given in to that extent. They tried to get him to write one. He refused to write it, but he did actually sign. And the very clever method used by the Arian leaders and by Constantius during this period would, humanly speaking, have meant the end of belief in the Orthodox view, were it not for the skillful writing of Athanasius and his careful discernment in his dealings with other people, and for the wise acts of a few of his associates, none of whom, however, at this time, showed the ability or the insight as much as Athanasius did. We won't go further into details. Maybe we'll say a word or two more in detail about Athanasius' life later when we look at the end of it. But we want to go on now to the next great change that occurred. And this is capital F, the reign of Julius. The reign of Julius. J-U-L-I-A-N. And under that, I'll call number one, Julian background. I mentioned that there were two other relatives of Constantine who were not killed.
When the soldiers massacred all of his relatives, they cut the streets off. These two little boys were not killed. And these two little boys, of whom the younger one was called Julian, were then put under tutelage by Constantia, but they were raised with such rigor and treated so by their uncle, Constantia, that they both developed quite a dislike of their uncle. And Gallus, the older one of the two, eventually made governor of an area of the empire, and there he proved himself very able. And Constantius became quite jealous of him. And Constantius ordered him to come to give a report on what he had done, how he conducted himself, and accused him of unfaithfulness, of treachery, and had him killed. You can imagine the effect of that on the younger brother, Julian. But Julian, as a young fellow, he was taught the Arian religion. And he disliked his uncle. He was a reader in the church. He went through the forms of claiming to be a Christian, but he hated everything connected with his uncle, and he secretly began studying Neoplatonism and old-fashioned paganism. And the time came when, after Gallus' death, Julian was old enough to take some part in affairs, and Constantius appointed him governor in Gaul, which is now France, and Julian went there as governor, and then there was an attack by the tribes outside the empire, a very serious attack, and that Julian proved himself to have unexpected military ability. He led the army, drove them back, established things very well in Gaul, and then he received orders from his uncle to come and give a report on how he's been doing, and the soldiers said, you know what happened to your brother under those circumstances, and whether he declared himself emperor, whether they declared him emperor, and he fell in with it. If he didn't, if they did, his life was in terrible danger anyway, whether he went along with it or not. So at any rate, he declared himself emperor. Constantius started with an army to meet him. Julian came toward him, and before the two armies met, Constantius was taken ill and died. And so this left Julian the emperor. He was the next in line. Constantius had no children. He was the next in line to the emperor. He had proved himself an excellent administrator and a good general. And he had the loyalty of the soldiers with whom he had been involved. And he was now recognized as emperor and had no internal difficulties during his reign. No uprisings, anything like that. Number one, that was Julian's background. Number two, Julian's religion. Julian, as soon as he became emperor, declared that he followed the old gods of Rome, who had made Rome great. And consequently, in history, he has generally been called Julian the Apostle. He declared that he followed the old gods of Rome. However, took the Neoplatonic philosophy and carried it out in detail. He demythologized the myths of the gods, so as to make them representatives of great moral principles and so on. He determined that he would show what kind of a highly moral, very fine rule a true pagan would carry out. And so he lived very freely and spent his time discussing philosophy and planning for the welfare of the empire. And he invited the pagan philosophers to come to his palace, where he gave them great honors and gave them everything that they could desire. And soon he found himself very disappointed with the attitude of these men. Instead of spending that time discussing philosophy with him and planning for the well-being of the empire, these men who had been living who had very little before and all rejoiced in the fine cooking of the palace and in the wonderful opportunities for luxury and pleasure of every kind. And people began to laugh at him for his athletic ways and for his determination to hold high moral principles and claim that these were derived from the gods of ancient Greece and Rome. And Julian had quite a problem, but he was determined to carry it through and to restore the empire to its old stand for the great pagan god as interpreted by the Neoplatonic philosophy. Number three, Julian's attitude to Christianity. Julian was determined to make Christianity ridiculous. He wanted to prove that it was wrong. He wanted to win his people away from it. And so he was anxious that nothing should be done that would win their sympathy in any way. He said these Christians are always fighting among themselves. Now he said, we will just let all the bishops that Constantius has sent into ourselves come back. And then he said, they'll all squabble among themselves, so they'll pretty well ruin the whole movement. So he gave orders, and Athanasius now, by Julian's orders, was restored to Alexandria because he let all the bishops come back. But to Julian's great disappointment, he found that when the Orthodox bishops went back, the churches began to go ahead, and things began to improve him. And after about a few months, he decided that Athanasius was the worst man to have in charge of a Christian church, and he made a great mistake, so he sent orders to send Athanasius off into a silent death. But Julian said, now in the schools where they studied the great classics of Greece and Rome, many of the leading teachers were Christians. And Julian said, how can a Christian who doesn't believe in a God teach these great words about the God? And so he gave orders. No Christian was to be allowed to teach the great class. And this was to be in any of the schools, including the Christian school. They either would abandon any teaching of the classics, or they would get non-Christians to teach them. Yeah, Julian said, that Jerusalem would be trodden on the foot of the Gentiles until the day of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And well, Jerusalem had been. 40 years after the death of Christ had been taken over by Titus first, and then 50 years later by Hadrian's army. No Jew had been allowed to go into Jerusalem under the orders of Hadrian for many years after that. People pointed to look at how Jerusalem's been trodden under for the Gentiles. Well, Julian said, I'll prove that Christ was a false prophet. So he sent word out. He said, the Jews can rebuild their temple in the heart of Jerusalem. We will give them help from the imperial treasury. Jews came from all over the empire with great gifts for the rebuilding of the temple. The day was set when it would happen. They were there with golden spades to start the digging. According to sermons that we have preserved from the very next year, it was given as a great proof of the truth of Christianity that when they began to dig, fire came out from the places that they were digging. There was a series of explosions that laborers ran away in terror and refused to come back and carry on with the work. Gibbon, in his history, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, tells about this, doesn't question that it was a fact. But Gibbon, who is quite anti-Christian in his general attitude, says, of course, this wasn't any divine intervention. He says the gases that had been gathered under in the caves under the temple during these centuries, when they were released, they naturally exploded and set fire and so on. It's purely a natural occurrence. But whatever caused it, the fact is that Jerusalem continues to be trodden under of the Gentiles. And the effort with imperial power to prove Christianity false and Christ a false prophet, in this case, did not work at all. Julian tried one thing after another to interfere with Christian progress, and of course there were many nominal Christians who found it to their advantage to declare themselves pagan. People began giving sacrifices again in temples which had been largely abandoned, but he had such difficulties that he began making more and more oppressive measures. And it would seem almost certain that if Julian had lived, real persecution would have come again. We have number four, Julian's death. Julian reigned from 361 to 363. And in 363, Julian, who was determined to restore the great glories of the ancient Roman Empire and of the Greek civilization, said that he was a bit like Alexander the Great. He wanted to imitate Alexander the Great. And so he determined to make an attack on the Persian Empire. Even if Alexander the Great conquered the Persian Empire, he was going to do it. So he led a great army into the Persian Empire. And they made their attack. The Persians drew back and then attacked them from the side.
And the army, the slaves, would make God some more dangerous with their situation. And after one of the battles, an arrow had struck against the ice, landed on Julian's body in a bright spot. And there he was. There has been arrows. There were many who said that Julian, as he was dying, said, "Thou hast conquered, O Galilean." Others said that he said, "Why have you forsaken me, O sun god?" Now, we're not quite sure what he said, but that he realized his life was a failure, looking to be certain in the situation, because there was no one to carry on in the line that he was pushing in. The man who was among the pagans, he was one of the 30 children last year, and they, you know, the idea of the entire life from Christianity, and it's trying to read in that pagan, American legend, and he had no uprisings against him. If he had had a long life, the Christian might have had a great difficulty in continuing. But he died there. The army was in a serious situation. The general got together and picked a soldier to be the new emperor. And he made a treaty with the Persians to allow the army to withdraw from their territory, had to surrender some territory in order to get out of the situation Julian had got them into. And this man, who became the new emperor, was an Orthodox Christian named Julian. We won't say much about him, though, because he didn't live very long, unfortunately. But this period of 2 years, or less, something less than 2 years, was, as you see, a very dramatic and very interesting period. And it probably was all for the good, for the progress of Christianity, that Constantine was followed by Constantius, and he by this. But the troubles were not yet over. It went to chapter B, the downfall of Arianism. And this took nearly another 20 years. This took nearly another 20 years. 356 to 381. We'll call it number one under this, the reign of Valens. V-A-L-E-N-S. But under that, I could call a reign of Julian. Julian was a soldier, an Orthodox Christian, a man who was opposed to Arianism. He had his hands full with the, getting him out of the military situation Julian had gotten him into. He handled it quite well, but within a period of less than a year, I believe, one day when it was quite cold, they had a stove in the tent, and they shut the doors of the tent too tightly. And the Yakuli time went to bed without sufficient things, and it was from the morning till dark from the garrison of the fire. And they put it in there. And so his life was a very brief life and had very little effect upon him, except that he had welcomed Athanasius back, and he had shown signs of favor to the Orthodox Christianity. But Julian was succeeded by a man called Valentinian, who felt that the empire was too great, too large for him to administer properly, and so divided it in two parts and put his brother Valens in control of the eastern half. And we're particularly interested in Valens, V-A-L-E-N-S, because this was the half in which the Christianity was most active. It was the half in which Athanasius was. And during this period, the attitude of the West was pretty largely to accept the Nicene, to take it and follow it without much argument or much attempt to penetrate into its deeper meaning. While the East is where the second letter, the West simply took it, and that was it. But the East was arguing and discussing and going into things, and the East is where Constantius had been until the last 10 years when he had the whole empire. Now Valens was in control in the East. So small B then would be the effort of Valens to carry on the policy of Constantius. And Valens endeavored to carry on Constantius' policy, but he could not do anything about it in the East, in the West. His power was here in the East. And during these years, there were a number of new leaders who came forward. Men of real ability, we'll have to look at a number of them to see something about their character and their accomplishments. None of them ranked quite on the level with Athanasius. that they were greatly influenced by that nation, and they were men of great energy. Men who, if the nation had not been there, would doubtless have been be considered as extremists. As it is, they were far superior to anybody of the previous period. And Athanasius was meeting with these men, and they were writing, they were doing what they could. Balance was trying in the East to advance the Arianism. But in, I know you were 378, Valens met a great attack from North Romania, a great attack of the Bavarian tribe. And in battle at Adrianople, he was killed. And that changed the whole political situation. But before that, Athanasius had died too. So our next heading will be number two, the last years of Athanasius. That was not until our next meeting. Tomorrow night. We will complete Athanasius tomorrow morning.